You know, many people are focusing on reducing CO2 emissions as quickly as possible over the next 30 years, you know, to reach this net zero by 2050. But, you know, should net zero really be the target?
Well, that's a question that has prompted a lot of discussion, and I think it'll be a big topic in Glasgow. I think what we're seeing are several things. The first is that 2050 is far enough away that it's hard to evaluate what is an airline or a bank that says we're going to be net zero by 2050. Well, what does that actually mean in the short term?
Yeah.
In the short term, very little. And the CEO can say that knowing he's going to be gone.
Yeah. So that was an easy commitment.
A very easy commitment to make. And the other thing, when you come back to the, the points I've made about tipping points and the importance of the next 20 years, is we're really starting to push much more for 2030.
Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast, where we talk with industry leaders, climate champions, and sustainability professionals who are making an impact in their businesses today. Each leader is solving complex challenges and providing solutions within their respective areas of expertise. And here's our host, Sean Grady.
Hello, ET Nation. I'm excited to announce that I have new Environmental Transformation Podcast t-shirts for sale. I can't think of a better way to let people know you care about the environment and that you support the show. Wear your t-shirt with pride, knowing you are making an impact and raising awareness with others about the environmental transformation topics we cover on the show. To get your t-shirt for only $20, go to my website at www.seankgrady.com and send me a message with your shirt size and address. I'll reach back out to you and coordinate payments. I currently accept Venmo and PayPal, so get your shirt today. Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Grady, and today's guest is Alan Miller. He's the co-author of his new book, Cut Super Climate Pollutants Now. How are you doing, Alan? Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sean. It's a pleasure to be with you. I've heard some of your previous podcasts, and you're doing a great job.
Hey, thanks. You know, for the listeners, we just had a technical difficulty, and we had to stop and re-record, so that's why this sounds a little crazy, but we're good. Hey, Alan, before we get started, you know, let's talk a little bit about your background. Tell us why did you write this book, and how long you've been involved in climate change or environmental industry?
Sure. So this book actually has some history. My two co-authors, Gerwood Zelke and Stephen O. Anderson, the three of us actually met in the mid-70s, some indication of our age. And all three of us at different times have been very much involved with global environment, particularly with before climate change was as much of an issue as it is today, with the protection of the ozone layer. Mm-hmm. And we kind of cut our teeth on that one, which, as it turns out, was important for several reasons. One, because the same chemicals that were threats to the ozone layer, we also now appreciate were sources of global warming. And in fact, if we had not replaced those when we did, we would actually have contributed an amount of warming from those chemicals equivalent to all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere today. Mm. So while it was primarily a program adopted to protect the ozone layer, it had an enormous relationship to climate change as well. So the three of us, although in different career trajectories, have made different contributions throughout our through passing decades. Myself, primarily in the University of Maryland for 7 years and in the World Bank for about 16 years. Stephen Anderson as a director at the EPA and working on protecting the ozone layer. And Gerwood Zelke as the founder and director of a very important environmental think tank called the Institute for Governance and sustainable development. So all three of us have, for multiple decades now, been very much engaged in these issues of the protecting the global environment.
Wow. So you guys are like the original gangsters of this whole environmental movement.
I suspect
You're the OG.
I suspect there may be those who have used that term for us. We've tried to, in our separate ways, through environmental regulations, through legal work, and through a lot of science writing, actually. So all three of us have cooperated over the years with leading scientists, Nobel laureates, and the like, who have helped define these issues as they've evolved over the past few decades.
Well, so the book is called Cut Super Climate Pollutants Now, and it's been released by Resetting Our Futures book series. Let's see. Show your book there, right? Resetting Our Future book
series. I'm very proud of the cover. This was actually the concept of one of the other Resetting the Future authors, Tom Bowman. I don't know if he's...
Oh, yeah. And we know Tom. He's been a friend of the show. He's been on twice.
Yeah. And Tom is terrific at this. I could never have come up with this brilliant cover design. But
kudos to Tom. Yeah. Yeah. Man, that's awesome. That's really good. Well, you know, so I think if I'm correct, you are now the Tom, Stephanie, Deb. There's another one in here. I think you're the fifth author of the book series that I've interviewed.
Well, I think it's been a great group, and it's also, you know, one of the great features of these books is that they were done very rapidly. Mm-hmm. So I've, by coincidence, been working on another book through a university publisher, and they've told me from the time they get my completed manuscript, it'll be about a year before it actually gets into print.
You're like, hey, look, I know you could do this faster. I've done it.
Well, I will say that in order to get it done as quickly as we did, it was, and this was true of Tom, Stephanie, and the others who you mentioned, we all had to really crash to do the writing.
Right.
And then the format was kind of limited. We weren't allowed to, you know, do a lot of fancy graphics or color pictures or the like. Mm-hmm. But in the trade-off was that, for example, in our case, we finished the book the middle of January, and it was available on Amazon April 14th. I still remember the exact date.
Wow, so, that's great. No,
so
that's
consequently,
great.
It's still pretty up to date, although we can talk about actually a few things. Mostly positive things have been happening since April when the book came out.
Well, I got to imagine, you know, Tim Ward had a lot of hand in making sure you guys met your schedules.
Oh, he did. Yes. Tim is the grand guru behind the Resetting Our Future. And no, it's actually been a very exciting process to be associated with these diverse group of authors. And there's still a couple more coming out. So
yeah, no,
you can
right.
look forward to having some additional authors on your program.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, I mean, the other one I was trying to remember is Bart Eads. We had Bart on too. And so
Bart is great.
Strategic Foresight. Shout out to Bart. Shout out to Stephanie Miller. She was our first with Zero Waste Living. That was a great book. And of course, Tom's, climate book was awesome too. We interviewed Tim too, just so I don't know if you remember seeing his episode or watching
his.
Yeah, his was good too. He's a character.
Yeah, Tim
really
is also
that.
Our biggest critic when we do podcasts. So
I'm good. Sure
they'll be telling me what I could have done better with you.
Good shout out to Tim. We love Tim. Okay, now let's get into the book here. So, you know, what do you mean by climate super pollutants, and you know, what makes them so super? Well, you know, let's dive into this.
Yeah, we were actually a little worried about calling them super because some people said, oh, that means they're good. Well, and in fact, in our case, we're calling them super pollutants, meaning super bad.
Yeah,
so,
right.
The reason that they're called super pollutants is kind of for two reasons. The first is they are way more potent in their impact and contribution to warming than carbon dioxide. So we got to deal with carbon dioxide. It's about 60% of the warming we have today. But the second thing is reducing carbon dioxide can only slow warming over decades. And we can talk about that in a little more detail. But in contrast, these four super pollutants that I talk about in the book not only have greenhouse impacts many, many times greater, mm-hmm. between, in the case of methane, it's about 80 sometimes carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. over a 20-year period. In the case of HFCs used as refrigerants in an air conditioning, it's about 1,200 times.
Mm.
So that's the first reason we call them super, super bad. And the second reason is that it turns out all four of these can be reduced in relatively short time periods. So the HFCs and methane can both be reduced in about 12 years, substantially reduced.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, the best opportunity we have over the next couple of decades to slow warming and stay below some of the targets that scientists and the Paris Agreement from 2015 identified of 2 degrees centigrade as a limit on warming, our best chance is really to focus on these four ones.
So we've got pollutants. Got methane, we've got the
HFC,
the hydrofluorocarbon.
You got it, Sean. Hydrofluorocarbons.
And then you've got what are the other? Okay, what's the other?
The other two are black carbon, which is primarily a particle, and thus that's why we say pollutant and not gas, because while the methane and HFCs are gases, black carbon is a particle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mainly a pollutant that comes out of cook stoves in developing countries that where you still have close to 1 billion people who don't have modern sources of cooking, fuel, mm-hmm. for cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also is released from poorly controlled diesel trucks and engines.
Mm.
And again, that's been more regulated in the developed world. So when you go to China, India, Indonesia, etc., you find the most emissions of black carbon. And then the fourth is tropospheric ozone, which is what we call the stratospheric ozone, the good ozone, and tropospheric ozone, the bad. It's, mm-hmm. the pollutant that we normally call smog.
Smog, so okay.
On those hot days when we used to have air pollution alerts all the time in, mm-hmm. Los Angeles,
right.
That was tropospheric ozone. And there's a link between tropospheric ozone and methane. So methane actually contributes to the formation of tropospheric ozone, but there are separate efforts in terms of automobile emissions and the like that help reduce tropospheric ozone as well. And both black carbon and tropospheric ozone have atmospheric lifetime measured in days to weeks. So the opportunity, again, over the next couple of years, not years, decades, is really with these four super climate pollutants.
Gotcha.
And not with carbon dioxide.
Well, your book makes a big point about, you know, the importance of what we can do about the climate change in the next 10 to 20 years. Why is action now so important when we've known about this for decades, really?
Yeah. And in fact, we've actually known about it for well over a century. And the first science I love to point out to associate CO2 with the absorption of heat was a woman named Eugenia Foote in the 1850s. Mm-hmm. And like many women scientists, she didn't get credit for it. But we now always in our writing like to point that out. But there have been, you're absolutely right that we've certainly thought of climate change as a problem for decades, even though we've kind of had some of the basic science for longer than that. The reason we focus so much on the next couple of decades is because of some concepts that we talk about also in the book. And I think we try to reduce some things that sound kind of very technical to make them very understandable, because they really are important and haven't been talked about enough in the media. Mm-hmm. And that's the notion of feedbacks and tipping points. So the idea of feedbacks is illustrated by what happens as ice melts at the poles, and particularly in Antarctica, where you replace light-colored ice with dark-colored water. Uh-huh. And that changes the albedo, or heat-absorbing property, of that whole region, such that this initial warming, that's, of course, from the temperature we've already experienced of about a degree centigrade, then is accelerated by this positive feedback.
So this is kind of like, Alan, a cause and effect type observation, right?
Yeah. It's pretty very much clearly established, although there are other issues, to be honest, where our understanding of exactly what the relationships between different events. So just as an example, the polar vortex, which was associated with the freeze in Texas, which mm-hmm. then resulted in severe power outages. The relationship, we think, is very strong to climate change, but it was such an extraordinary and unusual event that, to be honest, scientists are still saying, well, to be absolutely sure, we need to know
more data. We need more data.
Yeah. The other factor here is a concept, again, that we talk about in the book, which is a term called tipping points. And this is the notion that as temperatures warm, we may exceed thresholds beyond which things will happen that are very bad and very much irreversible. Mm. And an example of that is the warming of the Arctic and the melting of permafrost. And we know from lots of observation that the warming at the poles is much more rapid, that Alaska is warming faster than any part of the United States. Mm. And consequently, while there are 25,000 glaciers, so far as we know, maybe fewer than 100 have actually been expanding. 99.99% are accelerated melting. In fact, if any of your listeners have had the great experience of visiting Denali National Park in central Alaska, which is an experience I highly recommend, in the last few months, they've had to close the one accessible road into the center of the park, closing off several lodges, which are now inaccessible. And the reason is that the melting of glaciers has resulted in erosion that has made it extremely dangerous to use the road. Mm. And so there are now discussions of what may be multi-million-dollar, several-year projects to build a bridge over this area. Well, because of this accelerated melting, there is this risk that the permafrost will melt. And we know, although without, again, great specificity, that there are tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide and methane stored in the ground within the permafrost, and that this melting will release these so previously trapped greenhouse gases, and that may in turn result in what could be catastrophic accelerated warming.
This episode is sponsored by Regenesis. Have you noticed that the use of traditional methods to remediate PFAS contamination in groundwater are proving difficult for many who are struggling to manage long-term PFAS exposure? Pumpatreat systems using activated carbon filters are expensive and difficult to treat wide areas of PFAS contamination. But now, there's a proven alternative to pump and treat systems that eliminates PFAS risk for decades. Regenesis has developed PlumeStop, an in-situ remediation technology that solves PFAS remediation challenges in groundwater. Applied under low-pressure injection, PlumeStop's colloidal-activated carbon quickly and safely addresses PFAS without the expense and maintenance costs incurred with pump-and-treat systems. To learn more about PlumeStop and the science behind Regenesis' proprietary organic polymer dispersion chemistry, go to www.pfastreatment.org. That's www.pfastreatment.org.
When you hear a lot of, you know, climate change and all the issues around, you know, hey, we need to stop, you know, we need to reduce our CO2 emissions. I mean, is that really the right approach to adjusting the climate change, issues? I mean, are there other sources? I mean, it sounds like these four super pollutants have a bigger effect than, say, you know, reducing fossil fuel emissions only. Is that the case?
It's a source of some confusion. And in the book, we actually characterize these two different pathways as the climate sprint and the climate marathon.
Okay.
And we have to run both races.
Okay.
So the sprint is the reduction in the four super pollutants, which can be effective over the next 20 years.
All right.
The marathon we also have to do, because if we don't, the carbon dioxide keeps accumulating,
mm-hmm.
and we'll continue to heat the earth above and beyond whatever we accomplish from these reductions in the four super pollutants. So basically, that's why we emphasize, we're not saying stop focusing on carbon dioxide. We're just saying, recognize that's going to have a very slow, gradual effect,
mm-hmm.
probably on the order of, we do it well, about 25 years from now, where we'll gradually begin to see significant benefits. And until then, the best way we have to avoid the feedbacks and tipping points and staying within the limits that were discussed in the Paris Agreement of 2015, which was 2 degrees, ideally 1.5,
mm-hmm.
which is now both numbers that are being seriously questioned by current government commitments. But that's why we need both to answer your question.
Yeah. So in the book, you make a statement about cutting fossil fuel emissions results in a net warming for the next critical decade, for the next decade, perhaps longer, and avoids very little warming by the mid-century. So what did you mean by that? Because I was a little kind of like confused a bit, and I was like, let's dig into that.
Yeah, this is a somewhat tricky argument. And again, we have to emphasize, it's not to say we shouldn't reduce fossil fuel use. We absolutely have to. But it is to explain that the contribution these reductions will have for 20, 25 years or so will be very, very minor on slowing the rate of warming. And the reason for that is actually kind of the flip side of what I said about black carbon. So black carbon are particles. They don't last in the atmosphere very long, but as the name suggests, they're black.
Mm-hmm.
And the consequence of a black particle is that it absorbs heat. So by removing black carbon, we do help cool the atmosphere. In contrast, the problem that is, again, only not received nearly as much attention as it should, is that dirty coal combustion, as is the case with many coal-burning power plants, is accompanied with the release of sulfates. And you may remember the issue of sulfates from acid rain,
mm-hmm.
which was a mm-hmm. big issue that we addressed in the 1990 Clean Air Act by requiring scrubbers to remove sulfates. Well, in many parts of the world, sulfates are not substantially removed. And even with scrubbers, there are some sulfates released. And the difference between the black colored surface and the sulfates is the sulfates are light colored. And consequently, they actually, just like ice at the poles, reduce the rate of warming. So while they don't stay in the air very long, just like black carbon, they fall out of the atmosphere. If we reduce coal burning over the next 20, 25 years, we will also, throughout that period, be reducing sulfates. So over the longer term, the effect of reducing CO2 will be, as the climate marathon describes, to reduce warming. But for the next decade or two, it will be considerably offset by this reduction in cooling caused by removing simultaneously the emission of sulfates. So, but I'm glad you asked the question, because it's one of the more untold features of the whole climate science discussion. And often when I say, gee, removing CO2 isn't going to have a very big effect for a long time, it sounds like, oh, so then why bother? And the actual answer is, we got to do it.
Right.
It's going to take a lot longer to have any effect. And, you know, carbon dioxide, just to add one more bit of science, actually has a very, very long atmospheric life.
Yeah, I was going to ask that next question, because the super pollutants that you're talking about, they have a shorter half-life or life in the atmosphere versus CO2. I mean, it's a much longer, like exponentially longer.
Yeah, and a lot of the carbon dioxide actually stays for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And so consequently, anything we do in year one has a very minor effect on the carbon dioxide in the air. And we saw a vivid demonstration of that last year with the pandemic. Because as you can imagine, the pandemic reduced economic activity. You know, nobody was flying.
No
driving
cars,
was dramatically reduced.
Right.
You know, I even heard a study that said there's a group of academicians who look at how many frogs get squashed on highways every year. And you might want to have these guys on your show. It's a great story. Anyway, last year, there were hardly any frogs squashed, because there was so much less.
So now we have an overabundance of frogs right now, and we need more predators,
well,
probably, huh?
Bad news, good news is that this year they're getting squashed again, because people are driving once again.
Wow.
Well, the point of that is greenhouse gas emissions from carbon dioxide especially were down about 8% worldwide last year. But the amount in the atmosphere did not go down at all. And that just points out that carbon dioxide, because it stays in the atmosphere so long, you have to reduce the amount dramatically, like over 80% in annual emissions, before you start to see an effect on the amount in the atmosphere.
Well, let's talk about something. What can we do? What can be done to help accelerate, you know, the reduction of these climate super pollutants?
Yeah, and this is where, again, I think there's actually some somewhat good news to be had. So it turns out that HFCs already are the subject of an international agreement that was signed in 2016 that already mandates a substantial 80% plus reduction in coming decades. And that agreement has been ratified by China and India. And the U.S. has been in the process of working to ratify it. And indeed, the EPA has already adopted the regulations that are consistent with exactly what that international agreement says. So, so one of the good news things is we are in the process, but we could be doing it faster. And in our book, we actually suggest that this international agreement be somewhat accelerated to help reduce the HFCs. That's number one. The other really promising area of this year, even since our book came out in April, has been a focus increasingly on methane. And the part of the reason for that is that it turns out that the measures that are needed to reduce at least some of the methane emissions from oil and gas production and leaking pipelines are actually very feasible and economic to do. If you're an oil and gas producer, you don't want a leaky pipe, right?
Yeah, you want to capture that methane.
You want that methane because it doesn't do you any good if it's just leaks. So it turns out that the oil and gas companies have been relatively supportive of measures proposed by the Biden administration to reduce methane leakage. And only about a month ago, the United States and EU signed a pact, which has now been joined by 20 other countries, to substantially reduce methane over the next decade. The limitation, I should add, is that so far that methane pledge has not been joined by China, India, and Russia. And those are the majority of sources of methane leakage. But, you know, we have the climate meetings coming up in Glasgow in Scotland starting October 31st. And one of my hopes is that this methane pledge might be something which more countries will commit to while they're in Glasgow.
Right. That'd be good. I mean, I'd like to see that too.
I mean, there are other things that are important for methane, including reducing food waste, because landfills with organic material.
There's a lot there.
Yeah. I imagine Stephanie might have spoken about that when you had Stephanie Miller and her book on. And there's a linkage there between reducing food waste and reducing methane emissions.
Well, there's a big, big push to capture that methane as a renewable natural gas, right? And that's a big, that's money that's, evaporating into the atmosphere when you think about it in that perspective. And a lot of states and countries and agencies are starting to really push organic recycling as a, requirement instead of just, hey, just throw it in the trash and get it in the landfill and put it in the landfill. So there's going to be a lot of infrastructure that's going to be needed over the next, 10 to 20 years to build out enough, biodigesters and other, sure. Other facilities to, and compost facilities to process and manage all the organic food waste.
Well, I can tell you, we, partly after I read Stephanie Miller's book, I found a compost service, and I now have a bin on my kitchen counter. And
nice. Stephanie's going to be happy to hear that.
Oh, she is. I told her, believe me. The other issue that sometimes is more controversial is eating less beef.
Right.
But that is happening, especially in the industrialized countries where, we now have plant-based meat substitutes, the Impossible Burger that Burger King will sell you.
Yeah.
And in the Whole Foods stores, Beyond Meat products are becoming more and more available. McDonald's has a plant-based burger. KFC is introducing plant-based chicken nuggets. So I think that also, all of these things have what we in the environmental community refer to as co-benefits. So one reason for doing them is to reduce climate change. But, removing methane's also a pollutant, and it has significant health effects. And tropospheric ozone is a pollutant that has terrible health effects. And it also reduces agricultural productivity. So you look at the broader developmental picture, and the economics of these things are pretty good. And the co-benefits are very substantial when you look at the health and other environmental benefits. So, yeah.
Well, that's true.
If you're listening to this podcast, I'll bet you may be thinking, how can I level up and advance my career? If you want to get that promotion, increase your regulatory knowledge, gain professional recognition, and earn more money, then it's time to obtain an industry credential from the Institute of Hazardous Material Management. The IHMM offers 8 credentials that are ANSI approved for students, experienced skilled employees without a degree, and for the degreed professional looking to set themselves apart from the pack. Their credentials focus on 3 main areas: Certified Hazardous Material Manager, the CHMM, the Certified Dangerous Goods Professional, the CDGP, and the Certified Safety and Health Manager, the CSHM. If you become an IHMM credential professional, then you will be in the top 1% of your profession and your credential will have a global reach. Check out their programs they offer at www.ihmm.org. That's www.ihmm.org. What are you waiting for? Get started today.
You know, many people are focusing on reducing CO2 emissions as quickly as possible over the next 30 years, you know, to reach this net zero by 2050. But, you know, should net zero really be the target?
Well, that's a question that has prompted a lot of discussion, and I think it'll be a big topic in Glasgow. I think what we're seeing are several things. The first is that 2050 is far enough away that it's hard to evaluate what is an airline or a bank that says we're going to be net zero by 2050. Well, what does that actually mean in the short term?
Yeah.
In the short term, very little. And the CEO can say that knowing he's going to be gone.
Yeah. So that was an easy commitment.
A very easy commitment to make. And the other thing, when you come back to the points I've made about tipping points and the importance of the next 20 years, is we're really starting to push much more for 2030. And I think Ambassador Kerry, who's our special ambassador for climate change, former Secretary of State, he has referred to the meetings coming up in Glasgow as the last best hope. And I think that's because he increasingly is part of calling for these actions in the next 10 years and not focusing on 2050. On the other hand, working on these issues, I think you got to start somewhere.
Yeah. And,
you know, back when we banned, the first thing we did with protecting the ozone layer was we banned chemicals used in hairspray. Well, that was pretty easy. Hairsprays and deodorants, right?
Yeah.
Then we had to face the reality that, wow, these chemicals are actually being used in some stuff like electronics manufacturing and insulating materials and a whole bunch of other things that, and even in meter dose inhalers, right? So, which are approved by the FDA, and you can't just take out a chemical from those,
right?
It takes years. So we realized that you do have to focus on these things over time, and some of them are going to be take longer to do, which means that those things that we can do quickly, we should be doing quickly. The faster, the better. And then, you know, there are proposals for things like green hydrogen, and Bill Gates has done a book about all the technological innovation that can save the planet, and all that's great. It's just the problem is it's going to take time.
Mm-hmm.
And we emphasize in our book that 2050 is, we got to look at 2030. And
yeah. Yes,
there are things that will take until 2050 that may be very critical. But we're, you know, in our book, we also talk about removing CO2 from the atmosphere, which is a technology that is still
sequestration.
That's certainly early stage.
Yeah. There's a lot of studies going on with sequestration, but, you know, I've been struggling with the whole net zero by 2050 for a while. I'm thinking, you know, okay, so we're in this process of trying to, you know, meet a zero emission target by my operations or by my existence by the time I get, you know, basically 30 years from now. All the time, we're still emitting all the way until we get to, you know, 2050 out. And is that still going to be enough? I mean, that's I'm thinking more like, shouldn't we be thinking more like net negative and coming up with more of a net negative approach to reducing, you know, greenhouse gas emissions? Because I don't think 30 years from now, if we just get to net zero, we'll be any better off. I mean, we might be a little better off, but I mean, we're going to go 30 years of just emitting. I'm just kind of wondering, should the conversation be more focused on net negative?
Well, I would encourage you to maybe have another show where you focus on net negative, because I think you're absolutely right and you raise a very important issue. The challenge is that to achieve net negative really is going to require a lot of technological innovation. And, you know, the International Energy Agency has done scenarios for how to stay below 1.5 degrees, and they reach the interesting conclusion that about half of the things we need will be technologies that aren't commercially available today.
Okay, so, well, we need to innovate.
So, you know, maybe see if you can get Bill Gates on and have him talk about it.
Yeah, he can have an impact. I think he's got, you know,
he's got a fund, Breakthrough Energy Ventures, that, you know, is doing $1 billion+ a year looking into these early stage technologies. And there's no question we're going to have to be doing some things which may sound kind of crazy today. I mean, just as an example, I know there's a lot of work being done on changing what is fed to cows. So, you know, there are some research that says if you feed seaweed of certain varieties to cows, that you dramatically reduce the methane that otherwise
they produce,
you know, comes out of their mouths from indigestion, essentially.
Yeah, right. Well,
so, you know, that if you'd said 5 years ago, I want a few million dollars to try some seaweed on my cows, I think you'd have had trouble getting them a few million dollars. And these days we're starting to actually see money, you know, for these kinds of ideas. Prince William's Earthshot prizes that were just announced yesterday or 2 days ago, they include some things that kind of sound a little bit off the wall, but the reality is we're going to be needing to do some things to make, you know, we're still going to need materials even to have electric cars, right? You're going to need to have steel and aluminum. Well, today, steel, aluminum, cement, these are very, very carbon intensive to produce. So people are really starting to focus with substantial amounts of venture capital, looking at ways to have green steel, green cement. And, you know, here again, the issue is time, because I think there's every reason to think that, you know, given a few decades, we can achieve these things, scale them up, make sure they're used all over the world, et cetera. But it's a little bit like, you know, we're even arguing today about COVID vaccines, where we were able to come up with programs very, very fast. But so far, they've had almost no distribution in Africa, less than 5%. Mm. So a lot of the growth in greenhouse gas emissions is going to be in developing countries. It's not going to be in, you know, our rate of growth, our population growth. It's all slowing down.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
you look at China, India, Africa, that's where the issues are going to be. And so it's really a multi-layered issue to find the new technology, commercialize it, and get it into the places where it's going to really make a difference.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, many companies now are making really bold pledges to reduce emissions by 2050. I mean, a lot of oil and gas companies are doing it. A lot of other manufacturing companies are doing it, you know. And my question is, you know, is this going to be enough to get us there to avoid a climate crisis? Or, you know, I mean, should there be other regulatory forces in play to help achieve these goals?
Well, yeah, exactly. And we're having this debate right now around the infrastructure bill and its climate provisions, where, you know, a big chunk of the expected reduction in U.S. emissions is from a clean energy performance program that would incentivize utilities to accelerate adoption of renewable energy. And a senator from West Virginia, who I need not name, has said that he's opposed to that provision, which has seriously called it into question. Well, are there alternative ways that we might be able to achieve the same result? I think so, right? So I don't think the senator would be any more happy about a carbon tax, but that would be one way to do it. There also is the reality that EPA has a lot of regulatory authority under the Clean Air Act, which thanks to a Supreme Court decision, which barring reversal by now a very different membership of the Supreme Court, said EPA can regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act. So, you know, one of the things I would be saying to West Virginia is, well, if you don't want to incentivize utilities to do this, what do you think we're going to do? We're going to mandate it and adopt regulations to just simply force them to do it. And you'll have the, arguably the same result, and you won't have the transitional benefit of the subsidies that we're proposing in the infrastructure bill.
Well, do you also think that these types of regulatory approaches should be tied to other type of, you know, international agreements now, like, you know, well, like the Paris Agreement's a big one, right? I mean, so that should be a driver for what we're trying to do, you know, at a local level.
Well, I think that the way President Biden and Ambassador Kerry have viewed it is that the best role the U.S. can have is as a leader by example, and that it's very difficult for us to ask countries to do things we're not willing to do ourselves.
Right.
So, you know, the president has said he wants a very substantial reduction in emissions by 2030 and a very substantial increase in renewable energy use by utilities in the country. And that would, and that's why he's pushed for the infrastructure bill to be passed by October 31st, the beginning of the negotiations, so that the U.S. would have that much more credibility. He also, by the way, has proposed doubling the amount of financial aid that the United States gives poor developing countries for climate measures. So, which would be about $11 billion a year, which in the scheme of everything these days sounds
like a drop in the bucket.
Sounds like a drop in the bucket, yeah, when we're talking about trillions now. But, you know, again, his point is, look, if we're going to go there and be a leader and be credible, then these are, we have to lead by example, and we also have to be willing to recognize that poor developing countries are going to need a lot of help.
Well, so this is kind of like this link, and I had a question about this, is, you know, the link between achieving UN Sustainability Development Goals, the SDGs, you know, and reducing these super climate pollutant emissions. I mean, so is that really, kind of tie this together a bit here for that?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And in fact, I've personally been involved with a World Bank project, which has just been approved by a donor fund for $130 million of concessional lending and grants to promote sustainable cooling in poor developing countries. Now, cooling is, you know, you talk about win-win-win. Well, it's about five wins, because first, you're helping these countries to replace the HFCs. Second, you're hopefully at the same time improving the energy efficiency and reducing the power required to run the air conditioning and refrigeration. Mm-hmm. But in addition, in a lot of poor developing countries, the absence of cooling has been a huge factor in barriers to health. Because, for example, as you probably know, a lot of the vaccines require to be kept cold.
Right.
If you don't have cooling, you don't have distribution of vaccines. In addition, a lot of poor farmers are in rural areas where they can't get their products to market. And mm-hmm. consequently, their developmental future is limited essentially to a kind of...
A 10-mile radius, probably.
About a 10-mile radius, right. So if you're a fisherman, you're living off fish. If you're a rice farmer, you're living off rice. And I've, you know, worked in the World Bank. I've been to some of these places, and, you know, essentially it means your future is extremely limited. Well, one of the key factors which cooling can allow is helping to transport goods to market and avoid food losses. And so part of this project, which I helped, that's just been approved, as I said, is going to do what are support what are referred to as cold chain. And this is simply filling in that gap between the 10 mile or 5 mile radius that that farmer or fisherman has today, mm-hmm. and a market which may be a couple hundred miles away, but where they can get much more value for their product, and where their prospects, so, you know, instead of just producing the food for themselves, they can begin to plant higher value products based on the ability to get those to markets.
Sure.
And no, so you're absolutely right. In fact, a number of analyses have been done of exactly this link between sustainable development goals and climate change. And basically you end up saying almost all the sustainable development goals are to some degree linked with energy and climate. Mm. If you've got clean energy, you know, whereas if you're on a planet where you're being subject to droughts and extreme temperatures, you're not going to be able to meet the sustainable development goals. No way.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, that's good to hear. And it's good to kind of make the connection here.
Did you know E-Tank is the only environmental rental equipment company in the industry that offers a 100% certified clean guarantee at no additional cost? Well, this gives customers the peace of mind knowing that container contents from the previous renter isn't going to cross-contaminate the contents of the current customer and potentially cause liability concerns. You know, E-Tank also provides a one-of-a-kind complete maintenance program for all its rental items, including liquid-tight roll-off containers, fluid transfer pumps, and filtration system components. To learn more about the types of containers and pumps E-Tank supplies, check out their website at www.etank.net. So the next time you are faced with an environmentally challenging project, give E-Tank a call to help solve your problem. It's just that easy.
You know, if you're an individual, you're like, hey, well, what can I do? Give us three things individuals could do to reduce their emissions of these super pollutants.
Yeah. By coincidence, I was just reading an op-ed today arguing that telling people what they can do is a sop, that it makes them feel good, but doesn't accomplish very much. Well, we disagree with that. In the book, we actually do list quite a few things. So we already in this podcast have talked a little bit about reducing food waste, mm-hmm. and following the guidelines in Stephanie Miller's book.
Yeah, compost that stuff.
And composting is very good place to start. Another one of the measures that people really should think about is exercising their rights as citizens and getting in touch with their legislators at all levels to say, you know, I want action on climate change, and I specifically encourage you to look at some of these opportunities that we have for these short-lived climate pollutants with such substantial co-benefits. And, you know, not just focusing on the issues where we're so concerned about, gosh, if we reduce coal, we're going to cost West Virginia miners jobs. By the way, West Virginia is going to be one of the most flooded parts of America. So, you know, the consequence of any delay is going to be really, really bad for those people in those coal mining towns too. So, you know, there are a number of these things. We also talked a little bit about reducing somewhat less meat. Beef consumption is something which is healthy anyway. There are myriad of reasons. You don't have to stop eating it, but, you know, Meatless Mondays that Paul McCartney endorses is one good place to start. So we do have a list of things for individuals, and but I would really emphasize the benefits of raising greater awareness and beginning to emphasize to your legislators that you do want to see them acting on these issues.
Sure. So, you know, so other things we could think about are be like, you know, cut back on your vehicle usage, right? I mean,
a lot of things are happening with transportation, including promoting electric vehicles now, which is something I think is going to happen pretty rapidly. We're already seeing mandates in a number of countries on beginning to mandate certain significant percentages of electrics.
I just heard that Governor Newsom in California just banned the sale of all lawn care equipment. It's got to be electric.
That's coming. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't.
You can't buy a gas motor lawnmower.
Well, given how noisy they are, that would be another substantial benefit as far as I'm concerned. The electrics are quiet. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is ruffling some feathers, I think, in California. I don't know when that's going to take effect, but it's going to be quick. And,
you know, the other issue that has come up is this issue of methane, where a number of jurisdictions, including San Francisco, but also Phoenix, had attempted to ban new gas connections for cook stoves. And in a number of the Republican states, they have passed bans on local governments from doing it. So it's a little bit like mask mandates, where some of the local governments and schools in Florida did it, and then the state passed a law saying they couldn't do it. And so some of these are going to be major legal issues that will play out over time. Mm-hmm. But it's I don't know about you, Sean, but I have induction cook stove, electric, and it's great, you know?
Yeah, I've got electric stove. Yeah, I've got electric. And I really want to get into solar is what I want to. I want to implement solar. But right now it's not really it's cost prohibitive right now, unfortunately.
Well, you need to be in a state that gives you a subsidy. So yeah. in my state of Maryland, we have pretty favorable incentives for it. And my problem is just that I don't have the right exposure, and I'd have to cut down a bunch of the trees that otherwise provide important cooling through shading in the summertime. So it's kind of I did have a solar firm come, and they said we were not a. So what we did, what we did instead, let me tell you about that, is we bought into a company that we helped subsidize their construction of a solar power plant in Maryland. So what they do is, our state has a law that requires the utilities to buy any solar or wind at an agreed rate.
Right.
Which
right.
means that these companies know if they can build a plant for that cost,
they're going to be guaranteed revenue, right? So
all they do is they go out and find people like me who agree we will get our electricity through that provider. And I mean, in actuality, they pump their electricity into the system, and you can't distinguish where the electrons came from.
Right.
But indirectly, we are buying solar.
Gotcha. Well, that's great. I mean, I think, though, as soon as the solar panel situation for residential homes can be a DIY project, where you go to Home Depot and you pick up, you know, solar panels it's a plug and play scenario, and your utility box in the basement is just like, and we're it's done. Coming. You know, once we get to that simplicity and the cost is, you know, very cost effective, then I think we'll start to see solar pop up on all homes around the country.
Yeah. This is one of those regulatory issues where, again, it's the state regulation of the utility, the mandate and incentives that the state can provide to you as a homeowner, And then there is the potential for actually becoming a seller of electricity from your home back to the utility company. And that, again, depends on the rate approved and policy in the state. But, you know, I have friends who they, you know, not only they charge their electric car with their solar panel, and then sometimes when the sun is really shining, they actually have excess electricity and get a credit.
Right, off their bill. Right. And that's where we need to really drive, I think, because the biggest, I think, emission reduction that we could probably do as a country, and I mean, it could be, you know, implementing solar nationwide on residential homes. And
yeah,
but I think the utility grid right now, they're not positioned to be a storage facility. I mean, because there'd be a lot of storage, you know, needs of all the, you know, electricity generated from these facility, you know, these solar panels.
Yeah, we need a lot of backup storage with batteries, and we need much better transmission lines. Mm-hmm. And we also saw in Texas that what they used to think of was, we're Texas, we don't have to be connected to anybody else. Actually, in an age of climate change and intermittent power sources, that's a pathway for disaster of the sort that occurred in Texas, where, you know, they had billions of dollars of damages because of the loss of power there. So yeah,
that wasn't good.
Yeah. So you've got to see a lot more improvements in the transmission system and a lot more. But, you know, if we encourage people to put in these batteries are now becoming much more lower cost and affordable as well.
So, yeah. I mean, I think those are the major kind of technologies that are going to be, you know, deployed over the next 10 to 15 years. And we're going to see a big impact on climate reduction like that for sure. So, well, let me ask you this question. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about our prospects for avoiding a climate disaster?
So this is one of those really tough questions. I have come to the conclusion that I am cautiously optimistic that we can avoid the worst. So to just say a little more about that, I think we are starting to see with the agreement I talked about on HFC's replacement and the methane pledge, which I hope will gain momentum later this year. That gives me this cautious optimism. And I also, however, think we need to be lucky. So there are a lot of things that I mentioned earlier about these very dangerous and potentially catastrophic tipping points. And the reality is we don't know how close we are to them, and we can't say how much time we have left. So we're going to have to be a little bit lucky, and then we're going to have to hope that our government officials will respond to the message that is coming louder and louder as more and more people, you know, how many polar vortex events do we need? How many floods? How many disastrous floods do we need? You know, I mean,
I totally agree. And I think these climate issues are happening, the floods, the fires, the storms, there's a lot of recognition now in society that this is a real issue, and it's getting elevated at, you know, everyone's becoming more aware of it. And I think people are starting to voice their concerns, which is good. And you know, industry's leading. I think there's something to say when you have industry leaders saying, we're pledging this and we're making this a priority in our business. And we're going to try to achieve these goals. That's important. We've never had that before.
Yeah. And that voice is getting louder and louder. So we're seeing investors, BlackRock and CalSTRS out in California, the biggest pension fund, and the Harvard Endowment. They've all announced divestment from fossil fuels. And then we had this incredible vote earlier this year on the Exxon board, where three of the board members were overridden by climate savvy pension funds and the like, and replaced by more climate aware members of their 13-member board. So, you know, and Exxon was probably the most extreme and resistant in its policies over the last couple of decades. So I think if Exxon is feeling the heat, then you can be sure everybody else is.
Everybody
too.
Else is. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Well, Alan, thanks for coming on to the show today. We've got, you know, we've covered a lot of good ground on your book. Let's show the listeners the book again real quick so we can get them to check it out. I think it's really good. It's called Cut Super Climate Pollutants Now. It's by the Resetting Our Future book series. Highly recommend it. We'll put a link to the book on the website. Make sure you get a copy of it. It's a quick read, but it's very, very good. Very insightful. Alan and the other co-authors, you did a really great job of putting that together, and really glad you got to come on the show and talk about these super pollutants.
Thanks so much, Sean. A great group of questions, and it was my pleasure to be able to spend this time with you.
All right. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank our guest, Alan Miller, for coming onto the show today. If you want to learn more about Alan and his new book, Cut Super Climate Pollutants Now, you can get a copy of Alan's new book by going to www.resettingourfuture.com. That's www.resettingourfuture.com. You can also connect with him via LinkedIn, and we'll put a link to his contact information on my website. To listen to future environmental transformation podcasts, you can check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and other podcast networks, or from my website at www.seankgrady.com. You can also follow me on Instagram or the Environmental Transformation Podcast Facebook page. If you enjoy the episode, don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends. We'd also love to hear feedback from the ET Nation about the episode and any future podcast topics you'd like me to cover. Well, for now, thanks for listening, and until next time, make a positive impact in someone's life today.